Hiya, Duncan Green here. The latest roundup of posts on From Poverty to Power. Bit of an experiment this one because I'm babysitting or dog sitting my son's hyperactive spaniel, and he's liable to start barking at any moment and going crazy, at which point I'll have to give this up. But let's try because I need to get this done because I'm hopping on a train tomorrow, Friday, and going to Edinburgh. Every year I go to Edinburgh, to the Edinburgh Festival with my wife, Kathy, and we kind of do a massive immersion in new theatre, comedy, music, see about 25 shows in a week. And we've been doing it for years, and it's just a great way to have some time off in the summer. And I come back feeling far more cultured than when I went. Right, back to the show. My show, that is, not the Edinburgh shows. Links I liked. Let's talk about Barbie. I went to Barbie with a heavy heart, expecting something grim. It was brilliant. Right from the first scene, which is a fantastic spoof on 2001, A Space Odyssey. Okay, this isn't a spoiler. And I mean, as well as just like absolutely laughing my head off that much of the way through, it did make me reflect on, you know, how do you get a message about gender norms across in a way that doesn't alienate people, in a way that actually brings more people into the conversation. And that was borne out when I saw a really interesting map of a US Google Trends analysis of Barbie versus Oppenheimer. Yeah, both massive blockbuster films released at the same time. Barbie smashed it in the southern states, places like Texas. And the biggest Barbie win was Mississippi, the peak Barbie state. So, you know, that's getting to places where NGOs don't get to, and hats off to Greta Gerwig. I mean, that's just an amazing way to get a discussion going and have a lot of fun. So do go and see Barbie if you haven't seen it already. You will enjoy it. I promise you, you will enjoy it. Next post. Designing research for impact still seems difficult for a lot of academics. Why? Because I have one foot in the LSE and one in Oxfam, I sometimes get hauled in as a research user, which makes me sound a bit like I have a drug problem, but never mind. And I review research funding applications and discuss whether, if approved, the research is likely to have much impact on the real world. Now, I have to say that recent experiences have not been very positive. The vast majority of proposals seem to conflate impact with research dissemination, a heroic leap of faith, you know, changing the world one seminar at a time, or the academics outsource impact to partners such as NGOs and think tanks and just say in their applications, we're in partnership with this great NGO, they'll do the impact bit. So of the two, I guess I prefer the latter, but then the funder really should ask to see both evidence of genuine buy-in from the partners, because if you're at an NGO like I am, loads of people come and say, oh, would you mind being on our bid? But that means little more, yeah, unless there's money behind it, you're just bid candy. And it doesn't really make much difference in terms of the impact. So there's plenty written on how to genuinely design research for impact. We did a chapter from the Oxfam point of view, and then I reviewed a book, an excellent book called How to Engage Policymakers with Your Research. And there's links in the blog. In brief, proposals should identify the kinds of impact being sought, policy change, attitudinal shifts amongst the public or among decision makers, implementation of existing laws and policies, etc. They should provide a stakeholder mapping of the positions of key players around those impacts, supporters, waivers, opponents. They should show how the research plans to target some or all of these different individual groups, including during the research process itself, not just who do we send the papers to once they've been published. Which messengers or intermediaries will be recruited to convey the research to the relevant targets? Researchers themselves are not always the best place to persuade them. What potential critical junctures can you foresee, such as crises or changes of political leadership, that could open windows of opportunity for uptake, and how the research team is set up to spot and respond to them? Can you anticipate attacks or backlash against the research on sensitive issues, and how do you plan to respond to that? And how do you plan to review and adapt the influencing strategy in light of what you learn? Now, I'm not arguing for proposals to indicate specific impact outcomes. Most systems are way too complex for that. But an intentional plan based on asking questions on those points would probably help researchers improve their chances of impact. I also have some thoughts on what is blocking progress. Impact is still too often seen as an annoying hoop to jump through at the funding stage and then largely forgotten, at least until reporting at the end of the project. The incentives are largely personal or moral. I want to make a difference. Whereas the weight of professional incentives are around accumulating academic publications and earning the approval of peers, hence the focus on seminars. The timeline of advocacy with its focus on dancing with the system, jumping on unexpected windows of opportunity, etc., does not mesh with the relentless but slower pressure to write and publish. An academic is likely to pay a price if they drop their current research plans to rehash prior work to take advantage of a brief policy window of opportunity. I think there's still some residual snobbery as well, at least in some disciplines. You still hear terms like media don, which is not meant as a compliment. I'm delighted that my friend Harjun Chang is now an economics professor at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. But what on earth was Cambridge University thinking, not making a global public intellectual and brilliant mind into a professor while he was there? True, there is also some more justified concern that designing research for impact can damage the researcher's objectivity and credibility, hence the desire to pull in NGOs and think tanks as intermediaries. But overall, this conversation still feels messy and unresolved, at least in the UK. Any suggestions? Have any other countries or funders got it right? And quite a few people coming in on the comments on that. It's a hardy perennial, which a lot of academics think very hard about. And some of them came on to say, yes, they're getting stuff done. Some really good links to existing programs. So there's some good stuff there. Okay. Do southern-based transnationals behave worse than northern ones? This is a tricky issue. I wish I'd now lost on my page. Hold on a second. I'll just get there. So I'm a big fan of league tables for comparing performance by powerful players, whether governments, NGOs or corporates. If done well, they can prompt a race to the top with players competing to move up the table in successive years. The latest one of these to cross my timeline was the 2023 Food and Beverage Benchmark Report produced by Know the Chain, a programme of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre, which is run by my old boss, Phil Bloomer. It's an ambitious exercise. Know the Chain's 2023 revised methodology prioritises policy and process implementation in assessing whether companies' actions to address forced labour risks in their supply chains result in meaningful improvements for workers. While most companies demonstrate policy commitments to address forced labour in their supply chains, they consistently overlook the power of preventative measures, including supporting freedom of association and access to effective grievance mechanisms. This, coupled with a lack of evidence on remedy outcomes for workers, signals the existence of policies alone is insufficient to materially address forced labour risks and improve outcomes for workers. That's a bit wordy. What it's saying is they're just putting commitments on paper but not following through. To this end, only half of companies assessed score more than 10 out of 100. 5 companies provide no relevant information whatsoever on how they were addressing forced labour in their supply chains. Foshan Heitian, China's largest soy sauce manufacturer, Inner Mongolia, Yili Industrial Group, Asia's largest dairy company, Vietnam Dairy Products, Vietnam's largest dairy company, Want China Holdings Limited, China-based packaged foods company, and WH Group Limited, the world's largest pork producer. Generally low sector scores combined with a lack of transparency by such significant markets players should be cause for alarm for companies and their investors. The gap between the lowest and the highest scoring companies within the benchmark is also significant. While there is still room to improve, Woolworths Group, 56 out of 100, and Tesco, 52 out of 100, provide examples of better practice in addressing forced labour risks within the sector, posting particularly strong scores on key themes such as recruitment. Others in the benchmark have no excuse for not following this lead. Great. Good report, good league table. People will sit up and take notice, I hope. But a big elephant in the room went unmentioned in the report, as far as I could see. If you look at the list of bad guys and good guys, or the full table, notice anything? Yep, every one of the bad guys is a developing country multinational. Even the WH Group, the pork producer, is Chinese. The good guys are all from the global north. So why could that be? Well, off the top of my head, 3 possible slightly overlapping explanations. 1, southern transnationals are less susceptible to public campaigns. either because they're less dependent on their brand, or less likely to have shareholders because they're family-owned, or because public opinion in their home countries is not as strong on these issues as it is in the North. Second possibility, southern tier transnationals have a different conception of corporate responsibility from what is being measured here. So this is a bit, you know, could this be Eurocentric, the way they've constructed the index at the Human Rights Centre, which is after all based in London. Third, southern transnationals stick more firmly to Milton Friedman's dictum that the business of business is business, and they just don't care. Now, I was really sorry that the report didn't dig into this. Clearly, if we want to generate a race to the top and half the runners don't even consider themselves part of that race, we have to do more to understand what is going on and adapt tactics and narratives and what is being measured accordingly. Now, I sent a draft of this over to Phil and I got some interesting responses. And surprise, surprise, turns out things are a bit more complicated than I first thought. I won't try and do Phil's Yorkshire accent because it would come out all wrong, but here's what he says. In global supply chains, some of the worst performers are suppliers to some of the better performing companies. Ah, the complexity of long supply chains and their ability slash design to allow abusive conditions for those at the bottom. You can see this clearly in our Know the Chain report on phone and computer manufacturers. In many sectors, it is not a simple south-north divide. Canadian mining companies and Japanese companies can often be poor performers, for instance. And the irresponsible purchasing practices of many US and European brands drive abusive practice by suppliers. This was turbocharged in the pandemic. We would generally agree with the possible reasons you highlight for regional differences, though. But we'd advise against making major distinctions between those that score zero and those that score 10%. The impact of such dire scores for those caught in forced labour is likely the same. And in this larger group, there are some big Western brands and companies. Two other short remarks. The benchmarks do, as you say, help to generate a race to the top and an observable race in the catch-up group. But many of the laggards, the ones at the bottom, appear unmoved by the opprobrium of their score. This leads to the second point. Perhaps the most useful contribution of human rights benchmarks has been to provide governments of good faith with the evidence that their 40 years of reliance on the neoliberal precept that they can depend on companies' voluntary action, combined with a little bit of nudge politics, like the UK Modern Slavery Act, has been ineffective and a fig leaf for the sustained toleration of abuse of workers and communities in supply chains. I don't want to overclaim for benchmarks. It takes a whole movement to gain the current seismic shift to human rights and environmental due diligence regulation in Europe. But benchmarks evidence has been used systematically by us and others to demonstrate to interested governments the need for effective regulation to raise the minimum floor of corporate behaviour. It is also useful to counter the claims and lobby of reactionary business associations that there's no need for the inclusion of civil liability and heavy penalties for violation in this regulation because they have it all in hand through their sectoral voluntary schemes. Clearly not. So this is a point I've noticed elsewhere, that you know, people usually set up voluntary schemes versus regulatory schemes in opposition, but actually there's sometimes a kind of leeching across where a voluntary scheme and plenty of reporting and pushing by organisations like the Business and Human Rights Research Consortium can push things towards regulation in a very productive way. Final post of the week is one for the geeks, I think, from Sebastian Kratzer at the Centre for Humanitarian Dialogue. How adaptive monitoring and evaluation, M&E, from the peace sector can help demonstrate the value or impact of aid. A few years ago, Alex Douglas from the Centre for Humanitarian Dialogue shared his thoughts on this blog on what aid practitioners could learn from the peace sector's approach to operating in complex political environments. But the lessons from the peace world for other aid practitioners can be spun even further. Over the last decade, the peace sector has been developing and adapting M&E systems and tools to fit their context and ways of working. This evolution may hold some insights for the aid community in how to go beyond more traditional backwards-looking M&E to navigate today's volatile interest-based world of politics and aid. The high levels of complexity, uncertainty and unpredictability in conflict settings make the effectiveness of peace and aid programs harder to evaluate. Access to stakeholders and data can be extremely difficult. Even when possible, ethical concerns abound and the quality of data is so uncertain that often no reliable benchmarking, comparison or analysis may be possible. Due to the nature of its work, the peacemaking sector faces additional challenges. Facilitating dialogue between conflict parties is a highly political and unpredictable venture that relies on trust and relationships. Under these circumstances, traditional approaches to M&E with a focus on linear logic, attribution and causality, so attributing the change to the intervention, what we did, and showing that what we did caused a certain change, have never really been fit for purpose in peacemaking, and only sometimes in the aid sector. An alternative approach, well, with these limitations in mind, the peacemaking sector had to develop alternative systems and tools. Rather than obsessing about science-grade proof of impact that may never be possible in conflict settings, we have adopted a more comprehensive view on an engagement's final and interim results, strategy, and underpinning logic. This helps practitioners review and adapt their work while delivering sound proof of concept and supporting evidence to donors and the wider public, so that they understand that the work they support is making a valuable contribution to the peaceful resolution of a conflict. One example of an adaptive M&E system has been developed by the HD Centre, which Sebastian works for, which looks at both results and logic as determining the value of an activity shown in the three-level graphic. And the three-level graphic is a pyramid. At the top, you measure results. Second tier down, you assess strategy and adaptation. And the third tier, which I think was quite interesting, assure quality professional judgments. So this is something I hear from, you know, people who work with venture capitalists as well, that when they're, you know, when someone comes and asks for their money, they don't really look at the project proposal. They try and assess whether the person sitting in front of them is going to have quality professional judgments. And that's not something we normally think about very much. So I think that's quite interesting that that's popped up again in this other place, in peace processes. Having a theory of adaptive M&E is all well and good, but only if we actually manage to go beyond the traditional practices that impose static and linear programming and reporting. Over the last few years, various peace actors have developed a range of methods and tools to implement adaptive M&E in their engagements. The graphic below visualizes how we can integrate an adaptive M&E system as part of an ideal type peacemaking approach. The graphic is monstrous, so I'm not going to try and talk you through it, but it's there on the blog. This allows us to link our practice to results, as well as the tools and methods that are available and capable to measure, evaluate, and adapt them. I have a feeling the dog is about to go crazy, but let's see if I can get to the end of this before he does. This creative quest for better tools started with what is now one of the most established tools in the peacemaking sector, peer reviews. These bring together a team with critical peers from inside and outside the organisation to reflect on objectives, logic, assumptions, risks and results. They're designed to be low burden, respond to operational needs and enable teams to adapt faster and deliver better results in complex environments. At HD, we have conducted over 60 of these reviews over the last few years. The most recent one dealt with the question of how to bring fresh momentum to a discrete, here we go, to a discrete state level dialogue. I'm going to put this on pause and go and deal with the dog. Back in a moment. Right, where was I? I think we were at HD, which is Sebastian's organisation. We've conducted over 60 of these reviews over the last few years. The most recent one dealt with the question of how to bring fresh momentum to a discrete state-level dialogue. The review concluded with a reorientation of our work towards more sensitive issues, flashpoints, i.e. locations or issues with the potential to ignite or escalate conflict between states. Only a few weeks later, our colleagues hosted the next dialogue with an explicit focus on these flashpoints. Influential figures from participating states welcomed this change of focus to reduce the chances of unintended escalation and were soon discussing the highest risk locations. Getting to this point in the peace sector was not easy nor inevitable, but the result of deliberate action by the peacemaking practitioners to adapt their systems to something more suitable to their reality. In 2014, the HD Centre convened a first donor practitioner roundtable on the question of how to evaluate peacemaking. The first iterations of this roundtable can be described as a sort of group therapy for both donors and practitioners, airing all that was not well in their relationship. We have since met almost every year and turn this gathering into the place where the sector quietly develops and presents ideas and consensus on fit-for-purpose systems and tools. So, what's in it for us? Looking at the various debates across the development sector, an adaptive M&E approach could make three contributions to those seeking positive changes in the aid sector. It functions usually at the project level, but can also be applied to the whole of organisation level. At HD, we have structured our global results framework along these lines. A blog about Oxfam's evaluation practice, link in the blog, showed how sustained change is complex and occurs through the interactions of many actors. Adopting an adaptive M&E perspective at a higher level of an organisation may help better analyse, demonstrate and adapt efforts across an entire portfolio or group of organisations. Second, it could support the push for localisation and help slightly rebalance the power imbalances of the aid sector by empowering the people closer to the changes we're working for to define what a review and the reviewed engagement should focus on. Third, it can help align planning and analysis within and between the humanitarian development and peace sector. It was, for example, integrated into a UK aid-funded consortium to harness the insights of multiple partner organisations. The Australian Foreign Minister, DFAT, adapted the methodology to undertake a rapid regional conflict analysis involving its funding partners. The peace sector's journey in demonstrating the value of its contribution to peace and stability is far from over, especially as donor and official evaluation policies and guidelines are yet to catch up with these practices. But it may hold a few lessons for the aid sector in delivering and demonstrating the success of aid projects in complex political environments. And with that, I'm off to Edinburgh. Bye.